Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's podcast is hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting and brought to you by Tenable Network Security. Tenable is a serious company with some great products, and if you haven't looked into what they can do for you lately, you probably should. Later in this week's show, we'll be chatting with Tenable's CSO Marcus Ranham about how dumb the credit card transaction model is. We're also having a discussion this week with White Hat Security's Jeremiah Grossman. One of the world's leading web security researchers, Jeremiah recently wrote a somewhat controversial blog post in which he questioned the return on investment justification for the secure development lifecycle. It's heresy, I tells you, and it's coming up soon. But first up, it's my great pleasure to welcome to the show our regular news guest, Adam Metalstorm Boileau. In this first piece that we're discussing today, Adam, researchers have discovered that web application firewalls may not be all they're cracked up to be.
Well, that's really a big surprise, isn't it? Yeah, we can take the same crap tech we've used for, you know, antivirus and IDS and use it somewhere else, and look, surprised it fails in much the same ways. Oh, dear.
Yeah, it looks like a couple of guys from the at the OWASP Europe 2009 conference showed how some web application firewalls are, quoting from this story, prone to attack.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, it's the classic security versus complexity trade-off, isn't it? You know, we're going to solve security problems by bodging yet more complex protocol parsing on the front. And, you know, web application firewalls are more smoke and mirrors than most of these things, I think.
I mean, the way that they've been presented to me is that they're not really designed to catch attacks, but they're really handy when it comes time to mitigating a vulnerability before you get time to patch it.
Well, no, you can use web application firewalls to do good things, yes, but, you know, treating it like something you can just drop in front of a web app and have it magically just work, right? These things only work when you tune them for the specific application and purpose that you are, that you need them for. And people just aren't willing to do that. I mean, I've seen up-to-date web apps with, you know, five-year-old Apache mod security in front of them, and all the vulnerabilities are in the mod security rather than in the app it's trying to defend against, just because, you know, they decided they needed to tick the web app security, you know, web app firewall checkbox.
Yeah, fancy countermeasures I've found to not be too effective. We had an incident here with the local newspaper in my town kept getting owned and redirected to a porn site, which is, oh, just so hilarious, if you're 15, which the guy probably was. And their admin, you know, he's not really a security guy. He started putting all of these fancy scripts in front of it that would, like, drop people from certain proxies and things like this. And, of course, because my ISP uses a transparent proxy, all of a sudden I couldn't even get to my local newspaper anymore.
Yeah, so that's just not the way to do things, eh?
No, it is doing things wrong, TM. But this tool, it's called, these guys at OWASP released a tool called WAFWOOF. And what I find interesting about it is it actually is used, you can use it to do fingerprinting and detect what type of web application firewall someone's using. So it's like NMAP for WAFs.
Yeah, that is a very handy thing. I know I've used, you know, similar sorts of techniques on jobs before to fingerprint what the hell is getting in our way when we're, you know, busting on a web app. And typically getting past these things, you know, often is a matter of just playing with your, you know, Erlang encoding or something. Because very few of them correctly canonicalize the data that they're parsing.
All right, well, on to the next story. And hey, Adam, do you want a patch? Because there's patches everywhere. Everyone's got patches. I mean, if you've got a bit of software, chances are there was a patch that came out for it this week.
Yeah, no, it's been a pretty busy week for all those poor Windows admins, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Well, although it was a pretty modest update, it was, 14 vulnerabilities for PowerPoint have been closed. So it's obvious that they really looked at a lot of bugs in PowerPoint following this O-Day getting out there. It looks like they've taken a really solid look and they're fixing it up.
Which is good, but, you know, same. I feel bad for all the people running Acrobat still, huh?
Yeah, but hang on. No, they have actually released it.
Yeah, no, so there's some new Acrobat patches, which is good. But, you know, there's a lot of installed Acrobat out there, and how many things, you know, that you buy on the shelves come with a copy of Acrobat on the install CD?
The big winner this week in terms of the raw number of patches would have to be Apple, which has closed apparently 70 separate issues in a single patch.
But it's all right. Mac users are invulnerable to modern security issues.
Oh, no, of course. Of course, they are. Yeah. I mean, they're indestructible. I've seen the ads as well. But, yeah, 70 flaws. I think we'd find that, you know, probably around in the last year, they've certainly patched more bugs than have been done in Windows.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's because they're that far behind the curve in managing security intelligently, I think.
Yeah, but they're just so arrogant about it.
I'm thinking it's Apple's fault, or whether it's just the Apple users.
Yeah.
Maybe we should bag on them some more.
No, I think it's, I really do think it's been that marketing campaign, which is like, oh, hi, I'm a PC and I'm sick because I catch viruses. And the Mac guy's like, all like, oh, you suck. I don't get viruses because I'm, you know, 20 years younger than you and look good in cargo pants.
You should be in marketing, man.
No, that's like a last resort for someone in my position, actually, Adam. But anyway, moving on. And look, I love this piece because it just describes to me everything about the USA that people think is kind of wacky for us sitting outside the USA, which is the US. This is a story that came to us via Security Focus. The United States top commanding officer for all things cyber told reporters last week that a cyber attack could merit a conventional military response. I mean, I read this as if you DDoS us, we're going to do what we do best and bomb you.
Like, oh, dear. I mean, okay, the people who run those like GOIP systems like MaxMind, they got a lot to answer for, you know, for providing that kind of geolocation data for IP addresses. Because, yeah, this is going to end real badly. So my ISP's proxy, yeah, it's going to have a bad, bad day.
Yeah, so what you reckon they could start taking out transparent proxies, you know, when the script kiddies are having a crack at them?
Well, I mean, what else are they going to do, right? If you're sending them, you know, spoof DDoS or you're bouncing through a proxy or in heaven video, you're coming through your ISP's trans proxy. Well, then what are they supposed to do? Are they going to sit there and track back every single attack and then figure out that it's coming from a cyber cafe in Kabul and, you know, kaboom?
Well, it would be nice. It would be nice. I mean, I suppose it's going to be an extra incentive for people to make sure that they're looking after the security of their system, because if they become a node in a botnet, the next thing you know, you're going to have a bloody Navy SEAL team kicking in the door.
Dear, it is all a bit silly, isn't it? I mean, I suppose to some extent we are being a bit trite. I mean, obviously they're not going to go and drop cluster bombs on you because you got owned by Conflicker. But, you know, I suppose they're just kind of, you know, they've been saber-rattling at China for, what, the last couple of years about cyber attacks, and now they're just saying, yes, and by the way, you know, don't let us catch you in our traffic control, the air traffic control systems, or, you know, there'll be trouble, TM. But, I mean, really, it's just posturing, really, isn't it? I mean, you know, they're all, you know, arguing about where their budget goes and how they solve these problems as a country. And, as you say, blowing shit up is how they roll.
Yeah, but I just don't understand how blowing shit up would actually achieve anything in this case in particular. I don't really see what it achieves in most cases that they tend to blow people up. You know, in this case, what are you going to do? I mean, okay, you're getting some massive attack originating from China. Why don't you just change your routes and just drop them so they can't hack you anymore?
Well, I suppose if you're, you know, if you're Pentagon old guard, at least bombs you understand, right? You got to do something with all that expensive hardware you spend so much money on.
Yeah. Look, I guess, but it just seems a strange way of looking at things. Now on to a story from CNetNews.com, and the University of California, Berkeley, has been pwned in a major way with a lot of information on 160,000 students, alumni, and you know, various others in the hands of the bad guys.
Yeah, so this is what, like 160,000 people worth of like social security numbers and things it said, and the article seemed to imply SQL, you know, yet more SQL injection.
Mm.
The thing that I thought was most entertaining about this is there's a quote in the article from the vice chancellor of the university, and he says, their identities have not been stolen. Some data has been stolen. It's like, oh, really?
Yeah, it's like, you see what I did there? Look at this. Look at the pony. at the pony.
Yeah, I didn't steal any of your wealth. I just stole your money.
Zing. Yeah. Bullet dodged. PR coup. Hey-ya. That's some serious public relations ninjery there. But look, I don't think we really need to dwell on that. I mean, it's just another large-scale, fairly typical data loss incident. Pretty nasty stuff, but there you go.
Yeah, at least we're hearing about them.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, it is certainly a step in the right direction. Now, this next piece has really got the public's imagination happening. And what's happened is there was a little game that hit Twitter, which is come up with your Twitter porn name. And it became really popular, and a lot of people were putting stuff out there like, you know, the name of their first pet, the name of their street, things like that, personally identifiable information, which led some of the more paranoid out there to conclude that the whole thing was a phishing exercise. What do you think, Adam?
It seems pretty believable to me. I mean, whether or not it was, you know, is deliberate, certainly the information will be used for phishing now, I think, whether or not it was originally designed like that. But I would not be at all surprised. I mean, social networking is such a powerful tool for collecting phishing data, and, you know, people do use it for trolling and data collection for malicious purposes. So, you know, I would not be at all surprised if this was actually a legitimate phishing data collection exercise.
I don't think it was. I mean, that's just my gut feeling. I think it was just people disclosing
just
stuff they should...
People being dicks on the internet.
Yeah, people being dicks on the internet. Why look for a conspiracy when you can explain it with a f*** up? You know what I mean?
Fair enough. But yeah, once the data is out there, it almost doesn't matter why it was collected in the first place.
Yeah, well, this is kind of what I said when I was asked to comment on it, which is that, you know, hey, while this, I don't think this is a deliberate ploy to try to steal people's information, you shouldn't really be divulging that information in the first place. But it really does highlight that that condition, doesn't it, where people will divulge information on the internet and publish it and put it on the public record when they really don't realise that personal identifiable private information is private for a reason, which is that you can use it to authenticate your identity, and you shouldn't publish that stuff. It burns Sarah Palin, Paris Hilton, and Salma Hayek, who've had their private email accounts compromised by people guessing their secret answers, because they use their security question will be something that's on the public record, like where they went to high school. And then you just go to their Wikipedia entry, and voila, you know where they went to high school.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose it's symptomatic of a larger problem we have as a society, which is that we haven't got to the stage where we know how to authenticate people on a large scale. Like, I mean, some kind of government-scale PKI infrastructure is kind of what we need to be able to do this properly. And relying on, as you say, like, personal information that's not particularly personal isn't a scalable way of doing it, and especially in an era where social networking exists and that the records of that social networking are going to be in Google for the rest of time. You know, it just doesn't work. And we are going to have to at some point accept that reality and deal with what that means. And unfortunately, it's going to spell PKI.
I couldn't agree with you more, Adam. And, you know, this is also, you know, a firmly held position of mine, which is that until we have something as simple as a smart card where you can verify someone's identity, or you don't even need to verify their identity, you just need to verify that they have a certain item in their possession, that being a smart card with their name on it. I mean, once you actually lock down someone's identity to a device, to something that can just say, yeah, this is me, a lot of these problems go away, because all of a sudden personally identifiable information isn't valuable anymore to attackers.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of challenges in deploying any kind of infrastructure like that on such a large scale, you know, on a nationwide scale. But I mean, some countries have done it. Like, I believe in Estonia, they have a government PKI smart card-based system that allows you to authenticate who you are for government services and things. I mean, it is doable, but it's going to take us a while before we actually get to the stage where everyone's accepted that and we do it, I think.
Yeah, well, it's a political problem as well. The previous government here in Australia tried to roll it out, and all of a sudden it was like, you know, you'd think they were trying to, you know, RFID tag us from birth, you know. The reaction was pretty extreme, and I do understand that. But at the same time, we're getting to the point where something like that is going to be required if we want to not eliminate, but reduce fraud to more acceptable levels. We're just going to have to bite the bullet and give up some of our privacy.
Yeah, well, we need to at least, you know, find a system where we can, you know, without giving up too much privacy, still be able to assert our identity and make other other claims digitally, you know, in terms of signing or being able to, you know, timestamp things anonymously. There's a whole bunch of cryptographic tools we can use that hopefully will prevent us having to give up too much privacy to obtain the kind of benefits that we need as a society.
Mm-mm. Now, look, another sort of attack piece next, which came via Eleanor Mills, who writes for CNETnews.com. And apparently the FAA, which is the Federal Aviation Administration in the United States, some guys broke into their systems and were rattling around in there, and it's got people a little bit nervous.
Well, I mean, we've been hearing stories about the FAA getting hacked on and off for years, and, you know, by the sounds of some of the numbers in that article, you know, one of them was, 760 vulnerabilities in a web app they reviewed, or in web apps that they reviewed, and some of them, you know, sounded like front page, you know, login box SQL injection, you know, real bog standard stuff. And, you know, a network like that, you build it, you know, it evolves over time. And, you know, there's very little incentive, I guess, to mess with it, because, you know, if you break it, it costs you big money. So those things bit rot pretty hard, I think.
Yeah, well, I think anything involving anonymous attackers and aeroplanes is enough to make the US public a little bit jumpy. So I guess we're going to have to hope in this instance that the security team at the FAA gets a nice big budget kick.
Well, what I thought was good here is the spokeswoman for the FAA, despite this massive article, you know, detailing all sorts of vulnerabilities and the fact most hackers, you know, wandering around with all the passwords in their internal network, says she dismissed the notion hackers could gain access. I'm sorry, excuse me? yeah, so that's what they do. Instead of putting a big budget, you just have a spokesperson come out and say, actually, no, it's all fine. Don't worry about it.
This is an interesting one, Adam. There's a pirated copy of Windows 7, one of the release candidates, going around over peer-to-peer networks, and it has come certified pre-pwned with a Trojan, which is interesting. It's apparently infecting around 200 PCs an hour.
Yeah, so the numbers were like 27,000 boxes in one of the botnets that got its command and control system owned. Like that's not a bad effort, you know, 27k boxes. That's a good haul for a moderately sized botnet.
Yeah, I guess the only thing that I'd say about this though is that I would imagine people are rolling out Windows 7 just to test it, and they're not really going to be using it as their primary OS. So I wonder really, apart from being able to relay spam and do DDoS and all that good stuff, I don't see there being a huge risk of information loss in this instance.
I mean, I'm sure a lot of people are deploying Win 7 on, you know, in virtual machines or, as you say, on test systems. Although that said, a guy in the office over here, he's installing Win 7 on his brand new machine that he just ordered yesterday to use as his primary OS.
And I imagine too that they're putting this stuff, I mean, they're not going to be doing this in a DMZ either, are they? They're going to do it on their LAN. So, you know, if it pops out a shell, you could maybe have a little bit of a poke around behind the firewall.
Well, I'm sure if you own 27K machines, you'll get something useful out of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Now, from Wired's excellent 27B/6 blog, we have some hard numbers, some hard dollar figures being put on the Heartland credit card number breach. Apparently, it's cost the company $12.6 million so far, and counting.
Which seems kind of low to me, you know, given the what we were talking, like 100 million cards or worth.
It doesn't seem too diabolical, does it?
It doesn't really. I mean, it seems sort of within the scope of, well, I mean, you know, given you're bailing out the, you know, half the global economies with the big companies to the tunes of hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, $12 million worth of identity theft, no, it doesn't seem so bad.
Yeah, now it looked like...
Sounds like you just buy insurance and carry on.
Yeah. I wonder if this is a true figure, though. And you've got to worry about the... And you've got to wonder about the damage to their brand reputation. I mean, really, would you, as a merchant, want Heartland doing stuff for you after this?
Well, I mean, of course not. Hell no. But, you know, that's what corporate PR is for.
Yeah, but then again, I mean, maybe they're one of these companies that, you know, has had the kick in the bum, so they're going to be more conscious of not allowing it to happen again. I mean, do you think that logic works?
I suppose now that it has become so public, possibly. But, I mean, I've seen so many people get owned and then decide to cover it up that I have very little faith in, you know, people making good decisions around the sort of stuff that results in meaningful improvement. As a result of getting owned. I mean, most of the time, you know, people just want to deny it and get the hell on with their job.
Well, I guess we'll just have to see what happens to Heartland, and we'll have to keep an eye on their profit figures, or we'll have to rely on other journalists who are actually covering that beat to really tell us what happens to Heartland, because they've become a real pin-up for data loss, haven't they?
Yeah, well, for doing it wrong, and doing it wrong whilst being PCI certified.
Yeah. Okay, Adam, well, thanks a lot for taking the time out to chat to us this week, as always, and I'm sure we'll speak to you again soon.
Not a problem, man. I look forward to next time.
Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there with a look at this week's news headlines. Next up, it's time to have a chat with Jeremiah Grossman. He's a very well-known web application security specialist. And as I mentioned in the intro to this week's show, he's been taking a look at the practice of using return on investment to justify using a secure development lifecycle in the context of web applications. For compiled software like operating systems and installed applications, the SDL return on investment seems like a slam dunk, Grossman says. But it's starting to get a little more complicated when you're talking about web applications, as Jeremiah explains.
It is probably the right way to develop more secure software, but what I was talking about in the blog was analyzing the ROI. The conventional wisdom says secure is cheaper code or not as expensive, and I wanted to figure out what that meant from a web security context.
And what were your findings?
Well, when I started doing the research, you know, they were characterizing security vulnerabilities as nothing more than software defects, and defects, the later on in the software process that you choose to fix them, the more expensive they are to fix. But there's a big difference between a security vulnerability and a software defect, both from operational and also fixed. And also that the research was really dated, like late 80s, early 90s, which is pre-web. Certainly things have changed since then.
So you don't necessarily think that employing an SDL is always a slam dunk from a ROI perspective?
From a straight cost perspective, I don't think it's that straightforward, not when you're talking about web-based software. See, when you're talking about desktop or commercial software, when you make a fix, you have to, you know, test on a whole bunch of systems, a whole bunch of different operating systems. You might have to print CDs and print new documentation. But when it's a web-based vulnerability, you fix it on your systems and that's it. So clearly the costs are much different.
So what would be a different strategy? Would it be just to build the application and then focus more on testing after it's done?
Well, that would take a more of a risk analysis. It's certainly an option that companies can and have taken, whether they know it or not. And I would not advocate that one if you want to reduce the risk of your website. But I was just trying to figure out, I just didn't find a whole lot of value from a web security context that said writing secure software earlier was cheaper. This wasn't as cut and dry as I would have thought it would have been.
And what's been the reaction that you've had to this blog post? Because, I mean, it really does sound like heresy, doesn't it? I mean, how dare you question the virtues of the almighty SDL?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's there's a lot of religion in information security. I find that the more we question it, the better we can understand it, and the more we can measure it. And it's interesting when you bring up these topics, that what happens is from in web security, the cheaper the fix is after the fact, the less security ROI argument you have on fixing it earlier. The problem is the more expensive fixes tend to be after the fact. If you're not thinking my numbers aren't quite right, the more expensive the fixes are later, the more insurmountable this web security problem is when you multiply it out over the entire world of 200+ million websites.
Yes.
So we can't have it both ways. It's either cheaper before or really expensive after. It's either we got an unsolvable problem or the ROI model isn't there.
So really it just depends on the nature of the bugs that are going to pop up if you don't employ the SDL. So there's a bit of risk actually there if you proceed without using an SDL, you could wind up with some absolute clangers in your code that are going to cost you a lot of money to fix.
Correct. That is a possibility. Personally, I think the cost of when exploits actually happen when there's an incident would justify the SDL. I just don't like I'm not bought into the secure code equals cheaper code kind of argument yet, but I do like the SDL because it lowers the risk overall, those costs the organization. So I'm really not advocating to stop doing the SDL. Only if we're going to do it, let's do it for the right reasons that are actually accurate.
Yeah, now that is interesting. I imagine SDL, using an SDL, a secure development lifecycle, would certainly help you tick a few boxes when it comes time for a compliance check as well.
It does. For better or worse, people have a lot of different views on compliance. And, if it's something you have to do because an auditor says so, and what choice do you have?
Yeah, well, not much. Now, an interesting thing that you've done here is that you've actually gone out and tried to put dollar figures on certain types of bugs. And I believe it was a fairly informal poll. You put the word out through your blog and through Twitter. What did you find? Because I know that you have a very solid following among web application security people and even web application developers. And you were really asking them, say this type of bug pops up, how much does it cost you to fix them? So what were those results?
Well, the vulnerabilities I chose was just the plain vanilla, cross-site scripting vulnerability is the most prevalent issue, and also the most exploited SQL injection. Those two are really plaguing us. I figured I'd focus on those. And not only did I ask all the Twitter followers and people on the blog and whatever, I have 200+ enterprise customers, and they were all, they had no problem answering my answering questions. And answers range from a few hours of development time for coding the fix, testing, deploying it to as much as 100 hours. So I picked the median in there, 40 hours, assigned $100 per hour for developer time, and I got about a $4,000 price tag to fix individual issues. There is wiggle room in there. You know, the fixes could be a lot cheaper. They could be more expensive depending, but I thought the $4,000 figure was at least enough to get the conversation going.
I suppose also that a business logic flaw is going to be more expensive to fix than something like a simple CSRF. You know, if you've got to re-engineer your entire mechanism for authenticating users, that's going to cost you a truckload of money, yeah?
Absolutely. That is the ones that strike business logic, the insufficient authorization, the insufficient authentication. Those are almost systematic. And what you don't want is to have one of those where you have to completely re-architect your app. Those get really expensive. Those are, you know, straight design issues. Very much different than cross-site scripting and SQL injection, which are more implementation issues.
And they're a little bit easier to clean up, I would imagine.
That does seem to be the case, you know, both, you know, from having experience in development and also just conversing with lots of developers in the industry. It's tough to generalize vulnerability fixes, but we do know certain types. We do know a lot about cross-site scripting and SQL injection, so I think it's safe to somewhat generalize there. It's very difficult to calculate or to guesstimate what fixes are for what fixes will cost for business logic for all issues. So those will hit widely. That's why I kind of stayed very, very narrow in my calculations, or at least my estimates.
Mm-mm. Now, I don't know if you caught the news, but McAfee wound up wearing a bit of egg on its face a couple of weeks ago when it was found that they had a whole bunch of cross-site scripting and cross-site request forgery bugs actually in their PCI scanning portal online. What did you make of that news?
Everybody has these issues that, you know, like I said before, cross-site scripting is ever prevalent. It's everywhere. It's on just about every site we've ever come across. And as much as we know about it, and it has as how trivial the fix is, it's really difficult to do a 100% perfect job all the time. But that kind of goes back to the time and cost of fix. All the AV vendors got those issues fixed, I think, in a couple of days, if not maybe a day. So that's why this lends credibility to the argument that these things are really quick to fix.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that we should be doing it that way, only that we can.
So maybe like implementing an entire secure development lifecycle in order to just avoid things like cross-site scripting vulnerabilities in a non-critical sort of web app might not be worth the cash. But if you're talking about some sort of transactional-based site with very critical information, then you might want to go down that route.
Exactly. When you start looking at it from a risk and loss model, absolutely. So, you know, you don't want to get stuck in an ROI justification argument based on it's going to cost us, it's going to cost cheaper to develop secure code, when the reality is the security risks are going to be what you want to justify on. You know, perhaps McAfee would have been better served by a secure SDL on those quote-unquote non-important websites just due to brand damage alone.
All right. Well, Jeremiah Grossman, thank you as always for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business.
My pleasure as always. Thank you, Patrick.
Jeremiah Grossman on the line from the USA there with this week's feature interview. And of course, Jeremiah is with White Hat Security in the States. Next up, it's time for this week's sponsor interview, and we're chatting to Tenable Network Security's CSO, Marcus Ranham. Marcus and I, in this discussion, are wondering why the hell we haven't fixed the credit card transaction model yet. We're in the 21st century and still using just a simple string of digits punched into a card for online transactions. I asked Marcus how easy life would be for everyone if we just made some basic improvements to the transaction model around credit cards instead of ratcheting up the compliance burden imposed on merchants every couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, if these guys actually fixed this stuff sensibly, I think we would have, you know, vastly fewer problems. And I completely don't understand why the credit card companies haven't done, you know, a few, you know, simple little things like allowing internet merchants to have allowing me as a cardholder to say, I only purchase things over the internet that are being shipped to my house, period. Right? And wow, that would go a long way towards clearing certain things up. Or here's a checkbox list of the kinds of transactions that I will always come into a branch office before I undertake. If you just did a few of those kinds of things, which are not even really technical, they're just a couple fields in a database and some stuff like that. Oh, and by the other thing that they could do would be, you know, damn it, to record on my credit card and my ATM card what language I want my ATM interface to be in.
Yeah, that would come in handy sometimes.
You know, I keep thinking about patenting a few of these things because, you know, sooner or later they're going to catch up with it, and then I could come along with my hand out and go, hey, excuse me.
Yeah, excuse me, I'm taking you to court now. Okay, thanks, bye. Off to my mega yacht. Isn't that the story of your life, though, Marcus, that you should have patented certain things?
I don't really like the patent system. So here's a problem. You know, how can you be an anarchist and speak out in favor of big government? Well, how can you go around saying the patent system is corrupt and then try to cash in on it? It's a problem.
So you'd rather be broke than a hypocrite, is what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, but I mean, getting back onto PCI DSS, it seems to be a good standard for companies that want to stop data leaking out of their organizations. But I think the thing that we've got to realize is the reason all of these organizations that hold this data are getting attacked in such a spectacular fashion is because they're holding card data that can be exploited. If we remove the exploitability of the data, the problem goes away, and then everyone can take their credit card numbers and put them on their Facebook profile for all I care. Do you see what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Solve the problem and a tremendous amount of this goes away. You know, one of the things that could well happen is that somebody could come up and offer themselves as some kind of an aggregating service that does all of this correctly. You know, PayPal's getting close to that. I have a PayPal account that I keep a limited amount of cash in, and if I'm buying something I think might even be slightly dodgy, if I'm exposing my credit card to some small mom and pop shop, I use that instead.
Well, isn't the critical difference between PayPal and a credit card is that when you make a PayPal payment, you log into that service and you give that service authority to deposit your funds into the merchant's account. Whereas in a credit card transaction, that's reversed. You give the merchant your credit card number and say, I give you authority to deduct, $100 from my account, but don't take any more. And
exactly.
Don't give that information to anyone else. I mean, this is the thing. The credit card model is broke, and we can try to fix it with PCI DSS, or we can ditch it and start again. I mean, it was never intended for use over the internet.
Yeah, it's ultimately broken. And again, that's the kind of thing that, you know, they should have been doing something about this with software a long time ago. You know, why can't I go to my credit card company and say, you know, in the next 25 minutes, you're going to get a request from thus and such a website. It's approved for up to this amount of money.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, then you're actually making things sort of cumbersome for the user.
Right.
And we know that, big merchants don't want to do that. So, I mean, that's
right.
One possible reason there.
Yeah, but I mean, PayPal managed to do that without making it cumbersome, right? So, you know, I agree with you completely. These guys either have to figure out how to do it right, reinvent it, and make it not cumbersome, or die.
Mm-hmm. So what are some other practical suggestions? I mean, I know in the UK, if we look at the Apex data, the UK chip and PIN is mandated now, and fraud has just plummeted over there. Do you hold much hope for chip and PIN in other countries? Because Australia and the United States are actually behind the UK in this regard.
The fact that we are not using chip and PIN is absolutely ludicrous.
Mm.
It is absolutely ludicrous. I mean, I was part of a startup in 1996, 1995, 1996, V1 Corporation. We were doing smart card-enabled VPN tunneling stuff. And, you know, everybody went, oh, smart cards, wouldn't touch them. What the hell? And then you go over to Germany and, you know, you could go to a porn shop and you could use your smart card there and you could buy sandwiches with it across the street. And it just worked. And so, we're very primitive here about that. And I really don't get it because it's a fantastic technology.
Well, I remember once in Germany trying to buy cigarettes out of a vending machine, and I couldn't because I didn't carry a smart card that verified my age as being over 18 or whatever it was.
Right.
So some sympathetic, guy with cancerous lungs came up and helped me out.
Yeah, and if you really want to see how this stuff is done right, you look at what the Japanese are doing. It's crazy.
Same thing. Beer out of a vending machine at an airport. Believe it or not.
Yeah, you wave your cell phone at it, and it shows up on your phone bill. I mean, it's crazy.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, aren't we opening up a whole entire new can of worms with stuff like that? I mean, what if they get broken? Could be ugly, you know.
There's problems with the implementation. Obviously, if there's a massive failure in the implementation, you need to worry about that. But you know, I'm much less concerned about somebody being able to drain an account that I have a limited amount of money in that's attached to a device that I've authorized to tap that limited account than I am, you know, under the current situation, which is just utterly ludicrous, where, you know, somebody gets this information and they can go and they can apply for a mortgage in my name. You know, There should be a happy medium someplace between the two. And you know, I don't understand the resistance to people saying, oh, I don't like the idea of a national ID card. You know, when I hear someone say that, I hear one of two things. I either hear that there's some kind of a bizarre, fundamental Christian who believes that the end of days comes when everybody's carrying Satan's card, in which case I ignore them immediately because they're an idiot. Or they're worried about, you know, government data aggregate, which they should already be worried about, right? So you know, I'm very dismissive of people who are worried about these kind of national ID cards. I mean, this kind of thing should be done right. You know, there should be a card that's got a public area, it's got a private area, it should have in the private area stuff that the user can keep locked, like maybe you know, things that are unlockable upon my death kind of stuff. Like, I should be able to have a copy of my will, my public medical records in a public side, my private medical records in a private side. You know, these things are just, they seem completely obvious to me.
Well, you're a gun nut libertarian, so I've got to say I'm a little bit surprised.
I'm not a libertarian.
You're not a libertarian?
No, I'm just not a libertarian at all. And I'm not exactly a gun nut, but I have a lot of them. But no, I'm not a libertarian at all. I'm an anarchist.
You're an anarchist who believes in a national identity card.
Yes.
Okay. Do you see that that's somewhat conflicting?
No, because government is already compulsory. We're simply negotiating how compulsory it is.
Do you think that perhaps if, you know, other organizations that we do have to verify our identity to, and banks are a fantastic example of this, if we could start using the identity that the bank gave us to authenticate ourselves to the government, do you think people would find that less scary?
I don't know. I don't know. I think that they probably would find it scary, which is, you know, again, that is kind of weird. I mean, you know, I know people who, you know, were upset at the idea that commercial entities were using Social Security numbers, and I think they'd probably freak out even more at the idea that the IRS might ask for your brokerage account number.
Mm.
You know, but this is something that we are going to have to clear up. And really the issue is, at what point does the citizen retain the right to keep information private from the government and people that they choose to do business with? And if we ask that question, then what we really are looking at is we're looking at a card that has got multiple states where I should be able to flag things. I should be able to flag that my medical records are available to this list of people, and this is my will, and it's available to this list of people. And,
well, I don't know. I mean, I think it's just as simple. I think there is a need now in society. I don't think we even need to get as complicated as having private storage, public storage, things like that. I think it's really a case that we just need something that we can carry on our person, that if we are asked to, we can verify via telephone or the internet that we are actually in possession of that single physical object. It really is as simple as that. Once we've got that...
Yeah, it's really not very difficult.
No, it's not. And once we've got that, goodbye PCI DSS and goodbye a lot of bloody purchase orders and a lot of jobs in the information security space. Do you make that connection?
Yeah, well, but let's look at a more practical case, right? So the U.S. government Internal Revenue Service has this big problem that, you know, they're constantly finding people who are going, oh, hey, you know, let's look at Britney Spears' IRS filings, right? And so then they, you know, there's a hue and cry that this information has been accessed by somebody, and a contractor gets fired, and everything gets stuck neatly back underneath the rug. But why is it that there's not, okay, when you get your Social Security number, you also get a 10-digit number, which is the access-granting key to your file. So when you call the IRS and you say, I need to do such and such or such and such with my file, they say, you know, thank you, Mr. Anna, before we can access your file, because I'm not blanket authorized to access files, I need your access-granting key, and I give them that, separate from the Social Security number.
But the problem is that key is stealable. The problem is that key, so I can ring you up and say, hey, I'm the government, what's your super secret 10-digit key? Whereas if you've got that key in a protected storage area on a smart card and I ask you to insert it into your super-duper calculator thingy.
Yeah, sure, that key is stealable, but I mean, you've just raised the bar 150 miles because there's two problems, okay? There's one is the stealing the key, the stealing the key from the individual, and two is stealing the data from somebody that the individual has given the data to who's not holding it well. That's the problem we've got with the credit cards right now. Okay? If someone calls me up and asks for my, you know, my bank information, I tell them to sod off and I hang up the phone. But the problem is that my bank information is sitting all over the place on hard drives on networks that were built by idiots, right? So what we need is a way of saying, I'm granting you limited access to that information for the duration of our transaction, and after that, I'm taking it away. And you don't get that, you don't get any more or less than that with a card. Because if you're saying you're paranoid enough against the merchant that you need a card to protect against them, well, then, you know, that's fallacious reasoning. What if the merchant says, I want to do a $10 transaction and just charges you $100? If you don't trust the merchant in a transaction, you're screwed no matter what.
It's not a matter of trusting the merchant. It's a matter of trusting the merchant to secure that data. Now, I trust that the merchant is going to take what they say they're going to take, but then they're going to put my credit card into some piece of crap database that's never had a security patch applied to it, and then half of Russia is going to be selling it on the dark market.
Yeah, but if you don't trust that they're going to put it in a database that's secure, you shouldn't trust them to do a transaction reliably either.
But I want to buy their shiny things with lights on them.
And use cash. No, but seriously,
it won't go in the CD drive, Marcus. The cash.
Yeah, but seriously, if you're going to say that you don't trust them, then don't trust them at all. If you're going to trust them, now we can talk about what can you get away with if you're willing to trust them a certain amount.
The sad thing is, though, I mean, how many people are actually competent to make that assessment? How many average consumers are competent to make an assessment?
Well, you can see the results. Obviously, none of them are. Right. But I mean, there's ways that you can engineer around this kind of stuff. Like, you know, like what I was saying earlier, if I could say only ship goods to my home address that are paid for with my credit card, if I could click that checkbox, then sure, you know, a criminal could call up and try to social engineer me into unclicking that checkbox. I mean, come on, right? At a certain point, there are people who will fall for that. But you know, the thing that's so stupid about this situation is that, you know, even simple tools can go a long way towards making it better, and we're not even using those simple tools.
Point taken. Marcus Ranham, thanks a lot for your time again this week.
Well, my pleasure.
Marcus Ranham on the line from the USA there, rounding out this week's edition of the Risky Business Podcast. Don't forget to register at risky.biz for your chance to win an EPC supplied by Kaspersky Lab, as well as some other fantastic prizes. We'll be drawing that in a couple of weeks. And if you'd like to leave some feedback on this week's show, please do so. You can call Sydney on 02-8569 1835 or USA toll-free on 877-688-8417. I'm off to AusCert on Sunday for 4 days. For all of our coverage of the AusCert conference, just head to risky.biz or risky.biz/AusCert if you only want to see AusCert content. And of course, newsletter subscribers will be getting updates throughout the conference. And that's it. We're done. I hope to see some of you at the Royal Pines Resort over the next week at AusCert. Oh, and this track that you're hearing now is called Better, and it's by The Basics. They're touring Australia in June and July, and they're a great show, so you might want to go and check them out if they're coming to a venue near you. More info at thebasics.com.au. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Too many times you've heard, the time will heal our wounds. Yeah, no one's prepared to say just how soon. While we're here together, some tears together. But if we cried beside